Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Now, it seemed like the Brexit talks are beginning to descend into slight acrimony this weekend. On Sunday, the French Foreign Minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, predicted that the two sides would rip each other apart in the negotiations. Meanwhile, the government's chief Brexit negotiator, David Frost, is expected to give a speech this afternoon. James, is a sign that things are going downhill already, or a bit of just posturing, do you think?
Well, there's already an argument about whether we're appropriately translating Le Drian's remarks, but I think what is true is that these negotiations are going to be very contentious because the two sides start from very different positions. The UK view is all we want is a trade deal very similar to the one that you've agreed with Canada, Japan and South Korea. And because that's all we want, we should not be expected to abide by more conditions than they are. The EU view is no. You are so inextricably linked into our economic system that we can't accept this trade deal because you are so much closer without far greater restrictions. And I think this argument is going to go on and on and on. I think the one possible belief as to how this might be resolved is if you look at the way the UK is arguing, why should we sign up to following EU rules and standards on this stuff when our standards exceed those of are at the same level as or exceed those of the EU. And I think that possibly opens up in time if both sides wish to come to a compromise, a kind of trust but verify system where the trade deal, the UK commits to a non-regression clause, not going back from where it is now. And the EU says, yes, okay, we accept that. But we also accept that we also will say that we reserve the right if, you know, things change, that to impose tariffs and quotas, something along those lines. Now, I think that is the obvious compromise. I think the interesting question is whether in the time available, both sides are willing to get there, because I think you've got a clash of legal cultures here. You know, to Boris Johnson, it is very important that the UK is sovereign, so that the UK Parliament can do things if it wants to do them, and it is not just following EU rules from now until eternity. To the EU side, their view is, well, how can we know that your standards are high if we're not in charge of policing them? So I think you're going to see this tension going on for the next few months. And I think the kind of interesting question is, you know, essentially, how early do the two sides get the row out of the way so that they can actually get on to the compromising?
Do you think, Katie, that David Frost will try to strike a more aggressive tone then this afternoon, or go a bit more softly, I guess?
Well, the reports on what David Frost might say when he delivers his lecture to Brussels diplomats is that he will demand the same terms as Canada, South Korea and Japan. Now, there's been plenty already to direct quotes from Boris Johnson in speeches that the UK wants this is what they're asking for, and to deny the UK this would be to treat them unfairly if in comparison to other countries. So I think there is an element of talking tough, but I think more interestingly perhaps, there is this sense in government that these talks really might not be going anywhere, at least over the next couple of months. The two sides are so far apart in terms of what they are looking for that I think some have braced for effectively a standoff. It's why we started to hear the term Australia-style deal a few weeks ago. Now, and we said, oh, well, if we can't get the upper third Canada-style deal, we will just simply default and go to our plan B of an Australia-style deal, which is largely based on WTO. Now, I think the question is, how does the UK move to that? What type of talks can you have if both sides currently just kind of almost misjudge each other in terms of how far they are to move? And I do think we could be heading to a standoff, at least in the short term, while both sides almost evaluate where they can go from here. I think what the UK has on its side to a degree is just simply what Theresa May didn't, in the sense that because there is a large majority, there is more breathing space for the government to say, well, you're not listening to us on this, we're just going to go over here and have this. But there is another element here, which is there are reports over the weekend, the end of last week, that efforts for this US trade deal slowing down, or Boris Johnson is not going to go into America at the same pace as he was originally planned. Now, the UK side does want to have several trade conversations at the same time, and there are lots in the Tory party, particularly Eurosceptics, who think that this is the best way to put pressure on Brussels. But I have to say, when I speak to various figures in this government about a US trade deal. I don't get the sense that they believe this is something that is going to happen very quickly. And Mike Pompeo said it could happen by November, but that sort of breakneck speed, I think, would surprise even those involved were that to happen.
I think it all depends by what you mean by a trade deal. As Katie said, I think a kind of comprehensive US-UK trade deal is highly unlikely. You could strike some deals on various sectors more rapidly. And I mean, that is an interesting question. I think the other point here, which is that Theresa May was essentially trying to make the border as friction-free as possible. That was the whole rationale behind her Chequers plan. Because this government wants, at most, a Canada-Japan-South Korea-style delete-as-appropriate deal, the difference in terms of actually at the borders, the difference between that and WTO, it is there, but it is not completely transformative. Once you've accepted you're going to be properly outside of a single market in the customs union, you're talking about friction at borders. Canada is obviously a little bit less friction than WTO, but it's the acknowledgement of friction is the big change from the current situation today where lorries just roll on, roll off at Dover and Calais.
So the preparations of government will be quite similar either way, is that it?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's not like the old style no-deal planning. If someone comes into the room where they are, you know, where they're busy working away on their plans for the 1st of January 2021 and says, it's going to be a Canada-style deal, not WTO, you're not going to see half the room say, oh, well, we can just stop down tools then because we've got nothing else to do. You know, the things that you need to get in place for either of them are very much the same.
Moving on more domestically to the Conservative Party, there were reports over the weekend that multiple Tory MPs might be considering rebelling against the government on the finance bill. Kate, what's the mood like in the Tory party at the moment?
There are some people who are clearly offended and annoyed that they have not been promoted in the reshuffle. There are also some Tory MPs and I think perhaps some junior ministers who worry about the centralisation of power. That was the clear message of the reshuffle. So I think you have two different things going on here. I think after every reshuffle, you always are going to put some noses out of joint. I think what's interesting is very few have gone public with their annoyance. So you have a situation where I think George Freeman maybe has gone the boldest, former transport minister. He put out a letter questioning the centralisation of power. But otherwise, I think we're mainly getting anonymous, angry MPs. Now, the rebellion that has been touted, and it was in the papers this weekend, is this idea that a block of Tory backbenchers are going to vote against an aspect of the finance bill connected to budget, and that is how they're going to show or at least deliver a warning shot. Now, I think given that those involved think that at most they're going to get 20, 30 Tory MPs to do it, and a reminder that the government has a majority of 80, I don't think this is a warning shot which has any practical consequence, really, in terms of legislation. So I don't think it's quite the show of strength. Maybe it's intended to be. And I think it will also be interesting to see how many Tory MPs decide to go public and actually vote against it in a way when it will be known that they voted against this government. I mean, I do think that if you look at the figures who are going to cause the most problems for this government, a large majority, is often those who've already had ministerial careers. They feel that they are not going back in and they have less reason to try and behave. But I do think if you look at the intake from 2015-2017, there are some MPs in these groups who feel as though they have been overlooked for promotion. Some of the briefings have been, well, why are people like John Whittingdale going back into government? They've had their shot. They were culture secretary previously. Why are you not promoting younger talent? But it is a bold, ambitious, young-ish MP who at the start of, you know, four more years of this government decides to publicly try and cause it trouble and also fails to do that. I think it is a calculation that perhaps wouldn't be the wisest depending on your aims.
We've come to an end of a very odd period. So for 9 years, backbench MPs have had quite a lot of power because you've not had a government with a big, simple majority. You now do. And I mean, there is a bit of stress and tension about that. I think what you will see is an interesting question of where the government is prepared to meet the rebels. So Huawei is a good example, right? There are undoubtedly a bunch of Tory MPs who are unhappy about the Huawei decision. The government has gone some way to meeting them by saying that basically they wish to, over time, replace these high-risk vendors with high-trust vendors and indicating that they want to go down from that 35% cap. The rebels want a year, a date, at which this will hit 0%. The government hasn't yet been prepared to concede that. It'd be interesting to see if it does. I also think on what you might call extraneous elements of a government's agenda, so for example the BBC, then I think you will see people more prepared to kind of put their head above the parapet. You know, Katie says people are wondering why John Whittingdale has gone back into government. I think John Whittingdale has gone back into government because he is the person who knows the BBC brief backwards, forwards and sideways. You know, when he was Select Committee Chair of DCMS, he was very hot on this question. When he was Secretary of State at DCMS, he was very hot on this question. You know, who knows how to make BBC management sweat? It is John Whittingdale, hence his return. But I think, as the reaction to the Sunday Times story yesterday showed, I think there are also Tory MPs who are like, we're fine with, you know, clipping wings of, you know, how much managers are paid, all that kind of stuff. But we don't want a full-on conflict with the BBC. So I think you will see a lot more of that kind of stuff. But I think what Katie is right about is that, you know, people are not going to cross a Rubicon from which they can never return. If you vote against a budget, right, you are essentially endangering, A, whether you have the whip. Remember, this is someone who took the whip off 21 people who rebelled. Two, you are opening yourself up to the possibility of deselection within your own association. You know, also, once you've done that, you've got no other rebellions left to make. And as Katie said, there is until the summer of 2024, right? You want to kind of keep your powder dry. And so I would be surprised if we saw the rebellion this early. I think one other thing I would flag is something that Katie wrote about a few weeks ago, which is there is a balancing act between the Tory desire to shore up their new seats that they won off Labour at the last election versus the interests of traditionally Tory voting areas. I mean, you see that in two respects. One is infrastructure projects, right? There is, you know, we've had lots of rural Tory MPs standing up at PMQ saying, hang on a second, in this desire to get, you know, 5G and broadband, can you promise me that rural communities will not be forgotten? You know, that's one aspect of it. And the second is this whole argument about, you know, if there are going to be revenue raises in the budget to fund more spending, where should they come from? The mansion tax became a kind of a proxy for this argument, which is, you know, should you basically tax wealthier Tory voting areas because they've essentially got nowhere else to go and they're not having to pay all the Corbyn taxes? So even though it's a hit on them, you know, are they really going to vote for a Labour Party that wants to raise taxes on everyone earning over £80,000, which is, you know, what Keir Starmer's position still is? And Tory MPs were like, hang on a second, you know, we've just won our first proper majority and one of our first big acts is going to be to clobber homeowners when we are the party of the property-owning democracy. And so I think you see these tensions, I think, will become more of a thing over the coming years, and just how you balance out that electoral coalition, which might be similar on values, but on where it is on the economic spectrum is in very different places.
Katie, do you think the Tory manifesto might be a bit of a problem? I mean, we saw MPs of the weekend basically saying, oh, these attacks against the BBC are unjustified, all these proposals against the BBC are unjustified because they weren't mentioned in the manifesto. And it was quite a sort of a thin on policy actual pronouncements. But do you think this might be a source of people who sort of very softly rebel against the government by saying, well, we can because this wasn't what we were elected on?
Well, I think all the reasons James just listed as to why you really would have to choose the issue, you know, the hill you want to die on, still apply. If you're going to say, the reason I'm rebelling government from my own party with your large majority, Boris Johnson, is because you weren't quite clear enough when I went knocking on doors, I think is something some could say, but you still have all the same consequences in terms of what does that leave in your position, and is the policy being put forward something which ultimately the bulk of your supporters would go for or not? So I don't think the manifesto thing applies that much to the Tory party. I think some MPs, perhaps. I think where the manifesto is going to potentially create problems for the Conservatives is in the House of Lords, because you have a situation where, with the withdrawal agreement bill, where the Lords put back in, you know, amendments on child refugees, changes, and then they're voted out again. And at that point, the House of Lords did drop it. But I think where you are going to have a very long game of ping pong, so going back and forth between the two houses and potentially no resolution, is because on changes to the BBC, if you do get to that point, do you think some of the stories over the weekend perhaps not an accurate representation of exactly what's going to happen just yet, but of BBC, but also if you look at the constitutional reform, if you think of things to do with the judiciary, because the details are very light on the manifesto, I do think that gives figures in the House of Lords enough of a space or an ability to say, we are going to keep taking this out, we're going to keep saying no, because you don't have a mandate for this. So I think that's where the manifesto issue comes in, more than in terms of the Conservative Party in the Commons.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Salisbury Convention point, is the key thing here, which is the Tory manifesto commits to this Democracy and Rights Commission. So the Lords could not block the setting up of that government commission, but it will feel very free to block whatever that commission comes up with in terms of judicial review, for example, because it will simply say, well, you didn't explicitly say that you were going to do this. And then, you know, and then you get into the Parliament Act and a one-year delay and all that stuff. But, you know, I think if you look at it, you know, the manifesto issue isn't so much, as Katie said, it isn't so much with Tory MPs, it is with the Lords.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.